listen, listen, listen. God is speaking to us.
Kairos, Milwaukee United Church of Christ presents A Whale of a Tale. The sermon by Reverend Rick Skidmore, presented on Sunday, September 21st, 2014.
So last week, our topic was religious pluralism as the new social norm, a way to address the tensions and the conflicts that we find in the global wilderness that we are all of us a part of in this time. And I want to give credit where credit is due. I've mostly been reliant on the research and the writings of Eboo Patel, who is a young American Muslim and founder and director of the Interfaith Youth Corps. His book, Acts of Faith, I've quoted from many times. I've mentioned it in my newsletter memos, and also recommended that this become our reading material for our congregational book group, Acts of Faith. So the Interfaith Youth Corps is an international group trying to promote conversation and cooperation among faith-based communities and other communities of compassionate intent to find ways that we can celebrate and embrace our religious pluralism. And there are a variety of groups that try to address this issue, the Pluralism Project, you may have heard of, the National Council of Churches Interfaith Relations Commission, and also the Interfaith Alliance, all groups and organizations that are trying to address this issue. I think what makes the Interfaith Youth Corps unique, and I would also add the hand-in-hand work, what makes these organizations unique and I think so vital is the concentrated work they do among youth, young people, even small children. And to date, we have no Interfaith Youth Corps chapter in Oregon, but I'm hoping that will change. And our conference has begun to make plans to host a gathering of youth at our conference camp, Camp Adams, next spring, with the intention of starting another chapter of the Interfaith Youth Corps. I count this among the most important work that I can be doing our last year together, and I'm hoping that you will join in the effort for the sake of all of our futures. So then on to our lesson at hand. The book of Jonah. And the Hebrew Scriptures is one of the shortest books in the Bible, actually just about 3.5 pages long, but still, for our purposes this morning, too long to read in its entirety. So I'm going to get us started by reading the first 4 verses of this ancient tale as a kind of trailer, as a kind of tease, as a way to set the scene. Now the word of the Lord came to Jonah, saying, "Go at once to Nineveh, that great city, and cry out against it, for their wickedness has come up before me." But Jonah set out to flee from the presence of God, and he went down to Joppa and found a ship going to Tarshish. So he paid his fare, and he went on board to go away from the presence of the Lord. But the Lord hurled a great wind upon the sea, and such a mighty storm came upon the sea that the ship threatened to break up. And nevertheless, the crew rowed hard to bring the ship back to land, but they could not, for the sea grew more and more stormy against them. So they picked Jonah up and threw him into the sea, and the sea ceased from its raging. And the Lord provided a large fish to swallow up Jonah. And Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days and 3 nights. So some people consider this story the mother of all fabricated fish stories, a whale of a tale. But really, there's nothing that fishy about this story. I think Jonah is one of the most insightful books in all of Scripture. Because it's really a story about human arrogance and divine mercy. Also a story about mission. So God summons Jonah, asks him to go to Nineveh and tell the people there to shape up. Only Jonah doesn't want to go, and for a variety of reasons. So in a desperate attempt to flee from his assignment, Jonah ends up in the belly of a whale, a large fish. And this is the part we remember, of course, from Sunday school. The part about the whale swallowing the prophet and then suffering indigestion and spitting him back out into the world after 3 days. After that, Jonah, with a little more prodding from God, relents and he does what he's told. Only he's still copying an attitude about the whole deal. So when the Ninevites respond to his message and promise to shape up, then Jonah throws a fit because he can't stand the Ninevites. He was actually hoping that he would get to watch them suffer God's wrath, see them get what he thought they had coming to them. Only God here is merciful, and Jonah is miffed, cannot handle it. So a little context, I think, can be helpful here. The book of Jonah was written about 500 years before the time of Jesus, when the people of Israel were dealing with the exile and its aftermath. And you may recall, during the exile, the Jewish leadership was scattered to the far reaches of the Babylonian Empire. The intention being that if the Jewish people could only be assimilated, could only be swallowed up, you see, into Babylonian culture, then they would lose all sense of their own sacred history and culture, their own national and ethnic identity. Only the plan really had the opposite effect. Some very crucial, life-saving, faith-shaping events happened during this period of the exile in the lives of the Jewish people. For one, the synagogue movement began. I mean, with the temple gone and the people scattered, with the temple leveled and burned and buried, the people had to find their spiritual center in themselves. And so what they did is they gathered in homes to remember and to preserve their own faith history and traditions. And that was the birth, really, of the synagogue. And this also, these circumstances produced one of the most prolific periods in all history of literature. This is when most of the Hebrew scriptures were formed and written and collected. But something else happened during the exile and the return. A fierce nationalism began to develop among the Jewish people, a tribal loyalty and devotion to tradition which condemned close contact with anyone who wasn't a Jew. And the book of Jonah here really is a prophetic word in response to that kind of insular nationalism that was starting to take root among many of the people. So we can best be instructed by seeing Jonah, the story of Jonah, more as a parable rather than a historical event or narrative, a satirical story rather than a factual event. There may never have been a salty, mean-minded prophet named Jonah who was swallowed by a whale, but the author who wrote this story knew as much about God and the human spirit as any of the great Hebrew prophets. So we have here in this story a man who didn't want to get involved. He wanted to keep separate. He wanted to keep insular. When he was asked to help, he said no, and he said it emphatically. Said no to the idea of helping in general, and no to the idea of helping the people of Nineveh in particular, because he saw them as outside the scope of God's love. I mean, let's not mince words. He saw them, the Ninevites, as a bunch of ungodly infidels. He wants to live his own life. He wants to be his own person and to keep within the traditions and constraints of his own worldview, his own tribe, his own traditions, and not to be a part of some outlandish dream of God, especially this fantasy that includes welcoming strangers, even enemies. So Jonah was happy to explore the innermost regions of his own faith, wherever that might take him. He wants to live his own life amid his own people. You know, build the vacation home on the Mediterranean, kick back, watch a little football, enjoy the grandkids. So Jonah runs away from God. He is reluctant to say yes, because saying yes meant going a whole different direction with his life, one that was certainly risky and arduous. Saying yes meant giving up, among other things, some independence and his own self-identity and will. Jonah is reluctant to say yes because he can't stand the Ninevites. I mean, they might be neighbors in terms of geographic proximity, but that was pretty much where it ended. He detests these people. He won't even consider that they are in any way worthy of God's interest or concern. So who would be the Ninevites in our day? Muslims? Republicans? Democrats? Racists? I mean, if you can convince yourself that God will have nothing to do with certain groups of people, certain nations, certain tribes, then you're pretty much off the hook. You don't have to acknowledge them as children of God. You don't have to address their concerns. You don't have to feel anything for them. I mean, if God can push them away, then so can you, right? So when the people of Nineveh repent and God shows mercy, Jonah gets depressed. Jonah rails against God for forgiving these people. Jonah sees God's gracious and merciful nature as a character flaw. He can't fathom how God's grace could extend beyond Jonah's own borders and loyalties. So the book of Jonah then was this prophetic word to its time, challenging the nationalism that limited God's love to one people. And it still is a challenge for our time, to anybody who would define God's grace in the narrowest of terms by our own parochial understandings and boundaries. Turns out it's never easy to say yes to God. I mean, it's extremely challenging. It requires so much of us. And Jonah knew that he wasn't simply being asked to visit Nineveh and scold them or judge them. He knew that to be God's servant, to be God's messenger, he would have to change his relationship with the other, with his enemy, with himself, with God. And that requires great courage and patience and perspective and compassion. And the gospel stories have their fair share of fish tales as well. Jesus calls the fishermen brothers to turn their lives around and act on the good news that the dream of God is habitable for everybody. And as the disciples soon discover, their line of work is not for the timid or the faint of heart, but for those rather who have this rebel passion to see the world as one, and who are willing to stand against all that would seek to separate or divide, all of the, you know, conventional sanctions and exclusiveness, all those clever stereotypes and illusions about our own superiority. All that would seek to diminish neighbor, stranger, immigrant, other. Jesus spent a lot of his time calling the fishermen brothers and sisters to show some spine, to show some holy rage when justice, you know, lies face down in the street, and when lies consume us, calling death and destruction a strategy for peace. To rail against the ravaging of God's earth and the destruction of God's world, to rage when little children die of hunger as the tables of the rich are sagging with food. To show some holy rage against complacency and indifference and tribal speak. To restlessly seek to change the world until it conforms to that realm of God in all of its wildness and all of its beauty, the realm of God. You know, we live in an increasingly multicultural, pluralistic world. This really is face it, the dominant reality that shapes culture and religious life, our future. People of diverse racial and ethnic and cultural and religious backgrounds now live, you know, in closer proximity to one another. Our world has become increasingly more interdependent. And this reality challenges us. It does. It challenges our most basic assumptions and values and causes, yes, a great deal of discomfort. But as people of faith, we're asked to face our own assumptions and bias and to embrace this God-given opportunity, this Kairos moment, to work toward a more merciful and inclusive culture, society, community. So I would end here with the note of gratitude to Lee Gordon and people like Lee. You know, thank you for what you do. Thank you for showing us a world, a path, a way to move toward one another and not away from one another. A way that we can make the dream of God habitable. Peace of God. Thank you.